place your trust in the Lord. Because the Lord is steadfast in his love towards those who are his. Ruth chapter 1, verse 1 down through verse 18, as we've just read, comes here in the middle, actually, or the beginning, as it were, of the book of Judges. If you look there in verse 1 of chapter 1 of Ruth, it says, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. That sets the tone for the narrative that's going to play out, this historical event that plays out. You remember the days of the judges of Israel. In those days, there was no king in Israel, it says in the book of Judges, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. The nation of Israel had come into the promised land. They'd come into Canaan. Joshua's leading had ceased, and now was the time of the judges. The people of Israel would fall, not fall, they would more like jump headlong into idolatry. They would go and they would take wives of foreign nations, and those wives from foreign nations would lead the people into idolatry, and they would go headlong, full-fledged, into paganism, and they would forsake the Lord that brought them out of the land of Egypt, and they would then be sold into the hands of their enemies, just as God had promised them over and again through Moses. They'd be sold into the hands of their enemies. They'd be conquered by surrounding nations, and then what would God do? As he heard the cry of his people, after they had been humbled, after they had been humiliated, they call out to the Lord in their suffering, and so God would raise up a judge. He would raise up a mighty warrior. Sometimes a woman, many times a man, he would raise up a warrior who would go and lead the people of Israel out of that forsaken land, wherever they were, out of the hand of their oppressor, many times the Philistines, sometimes the Moabites, and he would deliver them back into Israel, and they would be safe. But once they got back in the land, and they got safe, and they got fat and happy, they went back to their old ways, didn't they? And they would again, there was no king in Israel in those days. Every man did what was right in his own eyes, and a judge would die. They'd leap headlong back into idolatry. And that is where you find the nation of Israel here when we see the narrative of the book of Ruth pop up. It's in these days of idolatry, these days of paganism. So it comes as no shock that there would be famine in the land, right? Because that was the promise of God, that when you come into the land of Canaan and you are eating off the land that is flowing with milk and honey, you get fat and happy and you forget the Lord that brought you out of Egypt. When you forget him, I'm going to hand you over to your enemies. I'm going to make drought come upon the land, famine to come upon the land, and you're going to be thoroughly impoverished. And then you'll begin to cry out again to the Lord. So that's where Israel finds itself, impoverished. So it says, in the days when the judges ruled, it's likely that the book of Ruth was recorded somewhere at the beginning, the earlier half at minimum of the book of Judges, because we read one of the main characters here in the book of Ruth is Boaz, and you remember who his mother was. His mother was Rahab. Rahab, the harlot. She had repented of her ways, obviously, but Rahab was the one who had helped out the spies who had come into Jericho to spy out the land. She had helped them out, and she was redeemed into the people of Israel. That was Boaz's mother, and so we're thinking that the book of Ruth was recording events that took place somewhere around the beginning of the book of Judges. The same events are taking place. So it says in verse 1, in the days when the judges ruled, there was a famine in the land. As a price to be paid for paganism, for idolatry, God will let you go your own way and reap the benefits of your decisions. He does that to us even today. God doesn't always stop us from making bad choices. A lot of times God will allow us to make bad choices and then to feel at the depths of our soul the consequence for those bad choices, so that we'll realize that the commands of the Lord, they're not burdensome. The commands of the Lord are love. He's protecting us from our own bad decisions. It says that there was a famine in the land, and a man of Bethlehem in Judah went to sojourn in the country of Moab. He, his wife, and his two sons. There's so much irony here just in verse 1. It says that there's a famine in the land, and a man from Bethlehem goes to Moab for safety, for shelter, for food. Bethlehem, the Hebrew word there, Bethlehem, actually means house of bread. How ironic is that? That the house of bread in the land flowing with milk and honey, the cupboards have gone bare. There's no plenty there. Why is it? Because it's not the house of bread that's providing for you. It's not the land flowing with milk and honey that is providing for you. It is the Lord your God that is providing for you. Where does this say that this man goes for shelter and for food? He goes to the land of Moab. Moab literally means son of the father, or son of father. That's a very interesting name. Moab was one of the sons of Lot, Abraham's nephew. You remember that after Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed by the Lord for their heinous acts, that Lot and his daughters and his wife, they come out of Sodom and Gomorrah. Lot's wife turns back. She doesn't trust the Lord, doesn't trust his angel. She's turned into a pillar of salt because she wants to hold on to the past. She wants to hold on to Sodom. So there Lot is left with his two daughters, and they commit incest. And the children that are born there are the children who are the fathers of pagan nations. One of those pagan nations, one of those sons that is born is Moab. That's why he is named son of father, because he literally is the son of his grandfather. Moab was a place of paganism, a place of idolatry founded on bad foundations, and it continued to grow up into such a plant. And so they're leaving the land of plenty. They're leaving the house of bread to go to a place that is forsaken by God in order to find a morsel of bread, because they see that in the pagan country there is more food than in the house of bread or in the land flowing with milk and honey. When it says that this man went to sojourn, literally he meant to walk. He's not going there to stay. It seems that Elimelech was a godly man. It says that he goes to sojourn in the country of Moab, he, his wife, and his two sons. The name of the man was Elimelech. Literally means God is king, El Melech. God is king. Seems to describe his character a bit, as these Old Testament names would. The name of the man was Elimelech, and the name of his wife, Naomi. And the names of his sons were Mahlon and Chilion. Maybe a bit of foreshadowing there. Mahlon actually sounds like the Hebrew word for sickness. Chilion sounds like the Hebrew word for consumption. Is it something we're eating you? And the names of his two sons were Mahlon and Chilion. They were Ephrathites of Bethlehem in Judah. They went into the country of Moab and remained there. So you would think, in the wisdom of Elimelech, he's trying to do the best that he can for his family. That's all a man can do. Trying to do the best for his family, to take care of them. And the best that he can come up with is, I'm going to go to a neighboring pagan nation, and maybe they have more blessing on them at this point than idolatrous Israel. So maybe they would find solace there. Maybe they would find protection there. But what does it say there in verse 3? It says, but. You would think that they would go and find food. You would think that they would go and find shelter. It says, but Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. They thought that finding food was the worst of their problems. Now the daddy's died. Now they have nobody to work but Mahlon and Chilion, the two sons there. But Elimelech, the husband of Naomi, died, and she was left with her two sons. These took Moabite wives. Just as you thought, it couldn't get any worse. They leave Bethlehem, they go to Moab, the daddy dies. Now the two sons take with themselves, they take pagan wives, violating the command of God not to intermarry with pagan nations, not because they are lesser people or not because they're not made in the image of God, but because they were idolatrous and they were going to lead them away from the Lord. But Mahlon and Chilion do what they think is best in their own eyes, and they take Moabite wives. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other, Ruth. They lived there about 10 years, and both Mahlon and Chilion, as is prophetic in their names, died, so that the woman was left without her two sons and her husband. When you think about Naomi's life and Naomi's situation, think also about the people of Israel. Think about their situation. They had come into the promised land, and it seemed like they had just forsaken the God who brought them there. Naomi goes away with her family to Moab to find shelter. She finds none, and now half her family, all the men in the family, are dead. She seems to be at the point of extinction. The people of Israel seem to be at the point of extinction. It seems like everything has gone to pot, and it's all run out, and it's about to come to an end. Israel's just teetering there on the end, and so is Naomi. She has nobody left now. Verse 6 says, "Then she arose with her daughters-in-law to return from the country of Moab, for she had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food." It's quite a hopeful verse, isn't it? No hope whatsoever. All we're talking about is people and their names and their bad decisions. But then at the first mention in the book of Ruth of the covenant name of God, the covenant name Yahweh, the first mention of his name is the mention of provision, the mention of faithfulness, that God had visited his people in Israel and he had begun to provide for them again. She had heard in the fields of Moab that the Lord had visited his people and given them food. Verse 7 says, "So she sat out from the place where she was with her two daughters-in-law." She sees God working somewhere, and she is going to go and meet him there. So she sets out with her two daughters-in-law, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. All it seems to be going well, but then verse 8 says, "But." So we're on our way back to Bethlehem, back to the house of bread, back to the land of Judah, to Israel. But it says, Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, she stops on the way and says, "Go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. I set you free. You don't have to care for me. Your husbands are dead. That covenant has been absolved by death, just as marriage is today. That covenant has been absolved. You are set free from your obligations. You are free to go your own way. You don't have to follow around an old woman," is what Naomi is saying. "You're not going to have to follow around an old woman and care for her. You need to go. You're young. You need to go and live your lives." We would need to ask ourselves the question, what would we do in that situation? Not as Naomi, but as Orpah or Ruth. Because those are the two decisions that we would have to make in that decision, in that time. Are we going to be merciful and gracious like God? Or are we going to be selfish and idolatrous like Orpah? But Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, "Go, return each of you," verse 8, "to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me. The Lord grant that you may find rest, each of you, in the house of her husband." And she kissed them, and they lifted up their voices and wept. And they said to her, "No, we'll return with you to your people." But Naomi said, "Turn back, my daughters. Why will you go with me? Have I yet sons in my womb that they may become your husbands? Turn back, my daughters, go your way, for I am too old to have a husband. If I should say I have hope, even if I should have a husband this night and should bear sons, would you therefore wait till they are grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is exceedingly bitter to me for your sake that the hand of the Lord has gone out against me." And they lifted up their voices and wept again. It seems that they are both attached to Naomi at this point, doesn't it? They both at least have an emotional attachment to their mother-in-law. We'll see in just a moment, in fact, the next sentence, you'll see how deep that connection actually runs for the one daughter-in-law, Orpah. It says, "And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her." Ruth was not going anywhere. Orpah was ready to say goodbye. And she said, Naomi says, verse 15, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods." That was the very reason why God had told the people of Israel that they were not to intermarry with the foreign nations. Because they may take those women out, they may take a spouse out of a foreign nation, but they're not going to change their heart by doing that. They're not going to take idolatry out of their heart. God is the one who does that. God is the one who changes the heart. And so Orpah, though she had lived there, though she had played the part, it seems, she had played the part of a faithful daughter-in-law, a faithful wife to her husband. Seems like she had played the part as being faithful to the God of Israel, because it seemed like she had forsaken her gods. But now it says that she kisses Naomi, goes back to her people, and to her gods. You notice how the writer of Ruth is very quick to distance Orpah and her idolatry from Naomi and Ruth. Orpah went back to her gods. Those gods are not our gods. You see Naomi and Ruth, Ruth's conversion, it seemed to be true. She was not feigning some allegiance to her husband, some spiritual allegiance to her husband just because her husband believed in Yahweh. She's not faking some allegiance to Yahweh because of her in-laws. It seems to be real. Those are Orpah's gods. Those are not Naomi's or Ruth's. So it says, and she said, verse 15, "See, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and to her gods. Return after your sister-in-law. I'm trying to cut you loose and let you go of your obligations here." Then again it says in verse 16, "But Ruth said, do not urge me to leave you or to return from following you. For where you go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people shall be my people, and your God my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. May the Lord do so to me, and more also, if anything but death parts me from you." And when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more. Naomi tries to absolve Ruth of any obligations she might have to her. "You are free from me, just like you are free from the obligations of serving your husband. He has passed on. You need no longer to serve me. You are free to go live your life and do what you want to do. You are not obligated to me." But you see Ruth's response. Ruth understands that there are many obligations that we may be free from in life. We are never free from the obligation of mercy and grace, and steadfast love. We're never free from the obligation to love people and to be merciful to people, to be gracious with people. So Ruth, against what would seem to be her own benefit, stays with Naomi, and she's going to care for her. You know, when you read verse 16 down through 18, you read the words of Ruth, "Do not urge me to leave you." She continues on there. What does that sound like to you? Her words from 16 to 18? That doesn't sound just like empty words to me. That sounds like a covenant. That sounds like a promise. "Where you go, I will go, and only death will part us." It comes as no surprise then that we would use texts like that for wedding ceremonies, because that is a covenant promise of devotion. "I am determined to death to be with you. Only death will separate us. Love is my obligation. This covenant is my obligation. No matter what comes, I have steadfast love toward you." That's what that Hebrew word chesed means. "I will have steadfast love. I will remain by you no matter what." And you see Ruth exhibiting that kind of love. Ruth was not faking her allegiance to Yahweh. Ruth's allegiance to the Lord had taken root in her heart and had changed her heart. She had left Moab, and she had also left those gods behind. Orpah had left Moab, but she had not left the gods behind, so she went back to them. When you read the book of Ruth, you might be tempted to think that Ruth is the main character of this book. You might be tempted to think that a character we haven't been introduced to yet, Boaz, you might be tempted to think that Boaz is the main character of this book. Why wouldn't it be Ruth? Ruth has shown steadfast love to her mother-in-law. Though she could have walked away free of charge, no obligation, she exhibits steadfast love. Surely, Ruth has got to be the main character of this story, of this historical narrative. But Ruth is not the main character here. God is the main character here. Ruth may be doing something on the microscopic level, on the people level, the individual level, but God is doing something on a national level here. God is doing something on a redemptive level here. Remember back that there's a famine in Israel. Why is there a famine in Israel? In those days, there was no king in Israel, and every man did what was right in his own eyes. So they reaped the consequences of their sin, of their idolatry. This system of judges is not going to work. This system of leaving everyone to their own self, this system of anarchy, autonomy, it's not going to work. There has to be a change. We need a godly leader. We need one anointed of God in order to lead God's people. Who is sufficient for these things other than the one anointed by God to lead his people? And so you have what seems to be the most unlikely of situations take place. A godly man, God is king is Elimelech's name, goes to a foreign nation just to provide for his family. His sons do a wicked thing and take Moabite wives. His sons then die. They can't even stay alive. Such is the power of humans, right? So now here's Naomi, abandoned by one daughter-in-law, clung to by another. And we see not only Ruth's steadfast love to Naomi, we see God's steadfast love to the people of Israel. Because while they are dawdling away in their idolatry and in their paganism, as they're sold off into the hands of their enemies, here is God providing the mother of Obed, who is the father of Jesse, who is the father of King David, the anointed one of God. God providing a redeemer, God providing his anointed king over Israel before they ever even got to that point. And he provided that king out of what seems the most unlikely of situations. You would think, we would think most of the time like Orpah, wouldn't we? I've gone through enough. I'm done. Right? I've gone through enough. I'm done. I'm set free. I'm cut loose. I'm going to go my own way, just like Orpah did. You would think that would be the way that God would react. You would think that God would look at his people and say, you just continually, after I brought you out of Egypt, after I swamped the Egyptians in the Red Sea, after I provided for you 40 years in the wilderness, after I helped you conquer, I conquered these nations before you and gave you, brought you into the land flowing with milk and honey. You turn your back on me. You would think if we were God, we would say what? I'm done. I'll just create a new people. Right? That's what we would do. But we're not God. He's, the way the Bible describes him is, he is holy, holy. Holy. There's nobody like him. He is steadfast in his love. He is committed in his love. And you see God loving his people, Israel, even in the midst of their idolatry, even in the midst of their going through the suffering that they so rightfully deserve, God provides for them a way of escape. God provides for them a redeemer, one who will lead the people into godliness. The steadfast love of the Lord remains forever with his people. You have one application from this text tonight. If you would place your trust in anyone, place your trust in the Lord. Because the Lord is steadfast in his love towards those who are his. He doesn't abandon them, even though we deserve it. You ever look at yourself and say, man, if I were God and I had to look at me, I'd just say, I'm done. Not going to deal with you anymore. You continue to do that. You continue to fall. You continue to slip and stumble and defy expectations. I'm done with you. Not so with God, is it? The Lord, gracious, slow to anger, and abounding in steadfast love and faithfulness. There is no one like Jesus. There is no one who loves like Jesus. Would you pray with me?